The two happiest times, I think, in my life are my childhood days on the streets in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, you know, the 14th Ward, up to the age of 9, huh? And then this period in Paris, particularly 32 and 33, when I lived in Clichy, outside the gates.
The voice of Henry Miller. Miller is our topic this week on From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the archive. We're going to hear an in-depth interview conducted in 1956 by Ben Grauer. The interview covers everything from Miller's happiest memories to why he admired French prostitutes so much. Throughout, we'll hear excerpts from a variety of his works. Here now is the interview conducted by Ben Grauer in 1956 with writer Henry Miller.
Well, Henry, let's see what we talk about today. What's on your mind? Some old experiences, some of your early days. What was your happiest time that you can think of? Something that that you reflect in your books, maybe.
Yes.
As I ask you.
Sure. Well,
obviously Paris in between 32 and 38, was that the happy time?
The two happiest times, I think, in my life are my childhood days on the streets in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, you know, the 14th Ward, up to the age of 9, huh? And then this period in Paris, particularly 32 and 33, when I lived in Clichy, outside the gates. It was a working man's quarter.
Now tell us about Clichy.
But Clichy was when I lived with this chap, Perlez, who wrote that book about me. And it was the period when I wrote Black Spring. And I was also writing the book on Lawrence, which I never finished. And I was writing, I think, Capricorn and some other. I was on about four books at one time. It was the first time we had a break in the sense that we had a place to live, do you see? And we had a bike, each of us. That was very important. We were working in the early part of that period on the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, down the cellar. We were both proofreaders. And we almost elected to be proofreaders rather than to be the upstairs guys, do you see? No responsibilities, just this drudge work, which didn't kill us. We would start to work, first have a couple of coupes of champagne, which was about, I should think, about 7 cents then. Do you know, a coupe? Before starting out to take our walk to the office, you know.
What time of day?
Evening. Got to work, I think it was about 8 o'clock, 8:30, something like that. Worked till 2. And then we went to eat in a restaurant nearby, in a bistro, where all the prostitutes came in the evening for their meal with their maquereau, with their pimps, you see. We all ate at the same tables. And then the guys from upstairs also would come down. And we'd sit there till 3, 4, sometimes 5 in the morning. And then walk from there, you know, a long walk across Paris, you see, in the dead of the morning, the early hours of the morning. Marvelous, marvelous feeling. The only person you'd encounter would be the bicycle cops, always in pairs with their capes, don't you know, and their high boots, do you recall? That noise, that little grinding noise of the chain was very wonderful in the silence. Paris is so silent, I think, at night, you know? More so than any city I know of. Mm. Yes.
When you came
well,
to
it was days of carousing, working hard at the same time, burning the candle at both ends, don't you know? Yes.
Well, you finish at 2 and you had a good 2-hour dinner and a walk and then to bed. That
then
doesn't
to
sound,
bed.
Not
then,
burning much candle there, doing a little
well,
eating.
I mean, we had marvelous times, you know, in between. it didn't seem possible you could do. Now, when I think of it, having the quiet place in Big Sur, often the contrast enters my head. There, I had a job even, you know, night job, long walks, much drinking, feasting, you see, and bicycle rides, as I say. Yet I seem to have time for more things than I do living in the country where I'm supposedly isolated. It's a strange thing. That is one thing every exile in Paris talks about, I think. The fact that he could do everything in a day.
In Paris?
In Paris. It seemed so. You seem to have the opportunities for doing all manner of things in 24 hours was much greater than here. Anywhere here, do you know? I'll explain it. I can't any more than that it happened. I can't, you know.
You live quietly in Big Sur now. There are fewer interruptions.
There are more interruptions, in a sense. Then, nobody was bothering me, knocking at my door, you see. I had seclusion then. Now I'm exposed to the world. Anybody knocks any time of the day, you know, and I'm his victim.
You mean, then, to be productive, you've got to be unknown?
In a way, I think that's quite important, yes. It's almost so, unless you could erect rigid barriers around you, you know, which seems impossible. There's one man I often think of. You know this friend that I tell you about, Perlez? I enjoyed so much his routine. He had found out that if he only told himself that he would only write, say, 2 pages a day and no more, he'd feel wonderful the next day. And he would do it deliberately, though he could write 6, 8, or 10. He'd stop at the end of the page whether it was finished or not, that sentence, do you see? Years later, I found out that Thomas Mann wrote only 1 page a day and corrected it to the nth degree so that it would be perfect, but not more than 1 page. But the only thing is, Thomas Mann is unique in that he did it every day of his life, Sundays included, do you know, huh? There were no variations. And look what he turned out. What a massive production his is, huh? This is something very interesting, you know, because people think they've got to work like dogs, you see, and they work in spurts, don't you know? And then they're fatigued, and there are long layoffs, periods of disgust, you know, self-criticism.
But aren't there periods when a creative writer gets in touch with the electric current? And,
that's right.
And the wheels buzz faster?
I can. That's my experience, but I suppose each one decides for himself how he will approach his work. But the moral of this other is how much you can do by doing little and doing it regularly. Do you see what I mean? You know that in 1 page a day makes 365 pages, which is a good-sized book, isn't it?
As I write, night is falling and people are going to dinner. It's been a gray day, such as one often sees in Paris. Walking around the block to air my thoughts, I couldn't help but think of the tremendous contrast between the two cities, New York and Paris. It is the same hour, the same sort of day, and yet even the word gray, which brought about the association, has little in common with that gris, which to the ears of a Frenchman is capable of evoking a world of thought and feeling. Long ago, walking the streets of Paris, studying the watercolors on exhibit in the shop windows, I was aware of this singular absence of what is known as Payne's gray. I mention it because Paris, as everyone knows, is preeminently a gray city. I mention it because in the realm of watercolor, American painters use this made-to-order gray excessively and obsessively. In France, the range of grays is seemingly infinite. Here, the very effect of gray is lost.
That was from the opening to Quiet Days in Clichy.
Tell me, I don't know if you've ever told it in print. You're a Capricorn, means you were born in that astrological...
That means 21st of December to the 21st of January,
Is that any relationship to the title of Tropic of Cancer?
Well, yes, I had started with Tropic of Cancer. And that was a symbolic title I'd chosen for a number of reasons, primarily because the cancer is the crab. And the crab has the power or the ability to walk backwards, forwards, sideways, any direction, do you see, at ease. I like that symbol, do you know?
That indicated a man adept in his environment?
In a sense, able to go any direction at will, do you see? Yes, yes.
Tropic meant his area?
Yes, yes. Yes, it's very loose, you know, and of course it has the geographical thing, Tropic of Cancer, you know, the temperate zone. And my thought, well, I did that. Then I had no thought of the next titles, but when I came to the next one, I thought, well, why not make it Tropic of Capricorn, you see. I was going to try to have one for just the equator. Well, finally, I had made Black Spring. That had another great significance to me. But there was always the astrological implication, too, sure.
Cliché was a happy period, I can see that.
It was, yes.
What did your room cost you? Had you two of you lived in one little room?
No, we had what you'd call a flat. It had a kitchen and it had two bedrooms.
Oh, yes.
It had kitchen, two bedrooms, that was it, yes. And we were overjoyed when we got the money. We borrowed the money from some wealthy woman to pay the installment, the first installment. We arrived with our valises, and we turned the light on, and we look, and I saw part of the wallpaper torn. I go and I pull it away a little. He's pulling away at another part of the wall, and soon we noticed bed bugs crawling up and down the wall, you know. We dropped the valises, ran down to the concierge, you know, said we'll be back in 3 days, fumigate the place first.
And she did.
Yes, oh yes.
In the cafe,
but, yes.
The cafe that you, when you finished your work as proofreaders at the Chicago Tribune, you went to a cafe where the prostitutes and their lovers, their maquereau.
Yes.
Most of the girls have a steady fellow?
Yes, it seemed. There was only one I noticed who didn't. That was an Algerian girl. Oh, God, what a girl. Beautiful looking, heavy, you know, heavy face, but marvelous beauty, this North African type. And, extraordinarily enough, she was an artist, a painter, showed us her work. She wrote poetry. And she would come some nights with Paul Valéry's poems and read them to us.
Young girl?
Well, in her 30s, I'd say, yes.
That was pretty old.
None of them, by the way, looked very battered and bruised. We get this impression that prostitutes are such beaten-up creatures, do you see? The thing I always admired about a good French prostitute was that she didn't allow that to happen. She used her wits. And she didn't have that moral feeling that others do, like the English girls, let's say. You know, they get so beaten over it, don't they? These think, as I found them, well, it was something you have to do. It's a business. It's honorable. You're doing your best, you know. One day we'll retire. We'll find a man. We'll marry him. We'll go to the country and have children and have a farm, do you see? That's the thought, the ideal. And many do carry it out. Yes.
I want to get back to Clichy and
yes.
The days in Clichy and this fascinating kind of nightlife. I take it it was basically nightlife because you had a night job.
That's right. We would wake up, say, around noon every day, don't you know? And then have this breakfast, lunch sort of thing, and write a bit. And then go for a spin on the bike. You see, we weren't far from the outskirts of the city. We could dive into the suburbs, do you know? And we'd go to all manner of places. And then have a meal again before starting out to work. And often that restaurant where we ate before we went to work was another type of restaurant, a working man's restaurant. And the meals were very cheap there. I can just tell you, I can remember it cost about 10 francs then. And if we, 10 francs.
50 cents?
Less, about 25, 25 to 30, you see. And if we wanted to splurge, we'd raise it, say, to 14. That would give us a better wine, and it would give us, say, chicken instead of boiled beef or whatever it might be. Do you know? And that was a marvelous difference. 4 francs, just think of it. You know what that means, huh? A little jump like that. Now, let me tell you that the ordinary American in Paris, he'd be spending 18 to 30 francs a day for those meals and think he was eating reasonably well and moderately, do you see? Yes. But these were joints where we saw the same people every night. Sawdust floor, you know, paper laid over the table for each customer, a napkin, you know. And curious people. People that you only nodded to, some you said a phrase to, do you see? You never got into any real intimacy with them, but you always greeted them intimately, tenderly, do you know, as you entered. But there was never any intrusion on your privacy. And opposite it, we could watch outside the window across the street, there was a bordel. A hotel. And on the corner, especially on a rainy night, it was interesting. On the corner, just a few doors up the street, there always stood two or three girls with umbrellas up. That's such a strange, lovely sight, really, isn't it? It's so respectable at once, you know. And they look just like anybody else with the umbrella. And there they are soliciting. And then, while we'd be eating, you'd see them pass along, go up with their clients, you know, upstairs, do you see? There was this coming and going. That all seemed to wash in with the food, don't you know, huh? It was part of the repast, you know. Our bikes were hitched to the curb outside. yes. And, of course, you know, it was only a few blocks up that street. This was on the Rue de Clichy, leading up to the Place Clichy, where the famous Café Veplaire was. And that was quite a wonderful place. From there, you know, it was like Broadway, great blazing red lights all the way up to the Moulin Rouge there, the Place Pigalle, do you know? From the Café Veplaire up the block, about two blocks up, is the Gaumont Palace, the great movie house. Right near it was an impasse, a sort of a narrow building, like one of our Flatiron buildings, but a tiny building. And an impasse there with glowing lights like an inferno at night, red and blue lights.
The dead end?
Yes. And right in front of the cafe, a tiny little, cafe, it isn't a cafe, it's a bistro, you know, with two tables outside. Always back toward the entrance stood a girl, very attractive, Ben, about 25, with one leg. And she stood on this wooden leg. And she was a prostitute, and she had customers, regular ones, who preferred a girl with a wooden leg. Can you imagine such things? Yes, yes.
I am living at the Villa Borghese. There is not a crumb of dirt anywhere, nor a chair misplaced. We are all alone here, and we are dead. Last night, Boris discovered that he was lousy. I had to shave his armpits, and even then the itching did not stop. How can one get lousy in a beautiful place like this? But no matter. We might never have known each other so intimately, Boris and I, had it not been for the lice. Boris has just given me the summary of his view. He is a weather prophet. The weather will continue bad, he says. There will be more calamities, more death, more despair. Not the slightest indication of a change anywhere. The cancer of time is eating us away. Our heroes have killed themselves or are killing themselves. The hero, then, is not time, but timelessness. We must get in step, a lockstep, toward the prison of death. There is no escape. The weather will not change. It is now the fall of my second year in Paris. I was sent here for a reason I have not yet been able to fathom. I have no money, no resources, no hopes. I am the happiest man alive. A year ago, I thought that I was an artist. I no longer think about it. I am. Everything that was literature has fallen from me. There are no more books to be written, thank God. This, then, this is not a book. This is libel, slander, defamation of character. This is not a book in the ordinary sense of the word. No, this is a prolonged insult, a gob of spit in the face of art, a kick in the pants to God, man, destiny, time, love, beauty, what you will. I am going to sing for you, a little off-key perhaps, but I will sing. I will sing while you croak. I will dance over your dirty corpse. To sing, you must first open your mouth. You must have a pair of lungs and a little knowledge of music. It is not necessary to have an accordion or a guitar. The essential thing is to want to sing. This, then, is a song. I am singing.
That was the opening to Tropic of Cancer.
Leaving out all the complicated political problems of today and North Africa and the price of the franc, or whatever, which is the problems of this moment. What do you think that thing is that you feel? Why? What is it you like? Mm. What do you feel? Mm. What do they feel?
Yes.
Is it something that goes back to Corneille, Racine, Voltaire, or is it something today, or what
no,
is it?
My even think goes back farther, much farther than that, I think. In a sense, I mean that to us, it's as though France is the most unique country, certainly unique European country, that the whole history of France is exciting. It's full of high adventure. It's full of events of great orders. There is a lot of mysticism involved even in French history. There are figures that are really enigmatic in French history. Just to mention only one, like Joan of Arc, you know, it's something that you can't quite account for, do you see? But all of French history is imbued with this lustful life, a glamour, a sensuous quality where there's not only politics and power and war and revolution, which they add to the full, but great painting, great art, do you know? Great sculpture, great literature. The cultural thing has been one long thing from the beginning of its history. You start off with magnificent poets like Ronsard, Villon, do you see? And it never ceases. It doesn't break. There's a continuity, do you see, throughout all the ups and downs of the political scene, do you know? You feel that the French have been gifted in some strange way to enjoy a richness that other countries don't have. You think of the other great countries, and they've all been great, like Sweden, you know, like the Netherlands, and yet France, even I say if France is shrunk to the size of a nut, she'll exude this quality and she'll give off this radiance like ancient Greece did. It's a like the perfume from musk, you know, huh? It's strong. A little of it goes a great, great ways, you see. It penetrates all others, you know, and overpowers it, you see. One Frenchman in a room, by the way, have you ever noticed? Go into a room of people at a gathering, do you see? If there's one or two Frenchmen, but soon the whole room is gravitating around them because they're animated. They're alive to the fingertips. They walk in, and if they take their drink, they're not drunk right away. They start talking. And it's a great conversation. It's a great game, throwing it back to one another. And on a high level, do you see? Don't you feel that always? Why is it? I just get a bit envious of them, you know? Why? Why should these people dominate? But they do. They take over. They're more alive, I feel. Because they can discuss anything. You know, they can go off at any tangent. They're not just interested in one thing, you know. Their focus is broad. And they're floating on the bosom of tradition, on the waters, you know. There's this great, 2,000 years, isn't it, of culture.
There's something else I think you like about France. It comes in so much into your talking, into anyone's. And that's food. It isn't just food.
That's right. Look, he showed me an article written by Blaise Sandra about a book of mine that just came out.
Yeah.
And Sandra is discussing this book, and he says the inception of this book was at a over a repast. And he said, goes on to say, I remember another time over a repast with Henry Miller. He says it seems that much of Henry Miller's inspiration in writing always begins with food and drink. And there's a lot of truth in that. But when you say that, Ben, I think once again that that too is strong in my memory, that all things in Paris that were good, that were rich and cultural, centered around eating and drinking, and of course women. I must say one thing about the women always. A Frenchman knows how to include women. Have you ever noticed in this country that when there is a group of men and women, that somehow the women, unless they're drunk and take the aggressive, are relegated to a back seat? The men begin to dominate with their talk. But in a French group, the women, their voices rise. They sing in, they chime in, they have a place and they are listened to. And then they speak well, usually, do you know? I enjoy that. I think the French woman adds a great deal to a gathering, you see, where I would say the American woman very often is a drag on the whole thing. She brings it down, you see. It gets to another level, uninteresting.
What other level?
A level of clothes, of theater, of whatever she happens to be interested in. But she's not interested in the same things that men are, as a rule, do you see, and that she can hold her own.
You mean a French woman doesn't talk about clothes and theater?
Sure, she may. She may. And if she does, it's in a different way, too. It's got more sparkle and effervescence to it. But she is able to follow her husband or her lover, you know.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. From the Vault is a weekly series produced, written, and edited by Christopher Sprinkle, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and myself, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Thanks to the staff of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and special thanks to our volunteers, Alan Carmen, Joseph Velasca, TK Munyeka, and Karen Anonia. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening.